Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Taras Kuzio, who is a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taras Kuzio.
Hi, welcome.
Hello. And this shaky truce that's underway now has been broken by an incident at a checkpoint controlled by these armed pro-Russian militants. But there's a lot of suspicion to the extent to which it may have been the work of the GRU, Russian military intelligence, given the speed with which the Russian TV network controlled by Putin's close friend Dmitry Kislyov showed up at the scene and stoked outrage across the Russian media. So what's your understanding of what happened there and what its ramifications will be?
Well, the Ukraine Security Service have openly stated that the only individuals in that region were pro-Russian armed separatists. The Ukrainian far-right organization called Right Sector has also said that they were not involved. Ukrainian internet and social media is full of bloggers and other people who are openly ridiculing the Russian accusations. Computer geeks have had a field day doing various cartoons about the so-called Ukrainian national involvement in a whole history of incidents throughout the world in the last 30 years. They seem to be accused of everything these days. They're the bogeyman. So it's become a bit of a source of ridicule. This very much would seem to be, particularly because, as you said, the Russians seem to have the press release already ready before the incident, a preconceived provocation, an attempt to blame the Ukrainians' side to use the sort of nationalist bogeyman, as it was a bogeyman in the Soviet Union, and now with the new neo-Soviet regime in Moscow, a new bogeyman, to blame the Ukrainians for destroying the truce during the Easter weekend, which, is, of course, is very sacred for Orthodox and Catholic Christians. So it just seems a complete provocation. Unfortunately, though, the worst part of this is that because the media sphere in Russia is so controlled by Putin these days, even more than it was a few years ago, that many Russians will come to believe this because this is the only source of information that they have.
Well, what is do you think is the story behind this incident that took place at various synagogues, and particularly in Donetsk, where a lot of people now are speculating that because the head of the CIA made a trip recently to Kiev, which was not a secret trip, and then shortly thereafter, this incident blows up, and some suggesting that this was a kind of an American-inspired psyop. But our previous guests and John Kerry himself still insist that it was, as it happened, a manifestation of poisonous anti-Semitism amongst these Russian nationalists in eastern Ukraine.
Well, I mean, the idea is absolutely ludicrous that the head of the CIA would be somehow linking his visit to Kiev with the issuing of anti-Semitic leaflets in Donetsk. I mean, I've never been a spook in my life, but this doesn't seem to be the way that intelligence field works. The reason why it became known that the head of the CIA visited Kiev is because obviously the Ukrainians and the CIA and the American government wanted it to be known. I'm sure if he wanted to do a secret visit to Kiev, he could have done. But this was obviously leaked out as a potential warning to Putin that the American side is actually considering more than just diplomatic sanctions and accusations and condemnations, but also thinking of maybe, for example, exchange of in, of intelligence, surveillance, and potentially down the road even supply of defensive military equipment. This is all part of the process of international kind of signaling and deliberate leaking. Now, the leaflet in Donetsk has nothing to do with this. This is when I was in Kiev, I just came back 2 days ago. A colleague of mine who's an American who reports from Kiev for a Western newspaper had just returned from Donetsk, and he said he was astounded at the level of a kind of very perverse anti-Semitism amongst these pan-Slavic Russian nationalists in Donetsk. That's not surprising. Donetsk is very similar in its national identity to the Crimea, where you have this very curious blend of Russian, pan-Slavic, and Soviet nationalism, and where anti-Semitism historically, both in the Tsarist era and in the Soviet Union, where it was disguised as anti-Zionism, was always a very deeply felt question. And this has probably been stirred up as well by the Russians against local oligarchs in eastern Ukraine, many of whom do have Jewish background, as they do in Russia. And the reason why this is the case is that the Russians and the Russian regime is particularly wanting to stir up anti-oligarch sentiment in eastern Ukraine, because they're very afraid that the oligarchs there will strike some deal with Kiev over the heads of the protesters, as indeed is what has happened in neighboring region of Dnipropetrovsk, which is headed by oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. So I think this is part and parcel of Russian strategy. It sometimes goes out of control because the locals espouse what they really believe. This sort of curious blend of pro-Russian, pro-Soviet, anti-Semitism, and then Russian nationalism. But it's part and parcel of that sort of field of ideology. I don't think it's anything to do with the American side or the Ukrainian side.
So, what though this very weak government in Kiev clearly did in their attempt to exert authority over the East certainly floundered, and yeah. It's pretty clear to me that the East and probably most of Ukraine is thoroughly infiltrated by Russian and intelligence and paramilitary forces. So, what is likely to happen going forward here, given that it's pretty clear, I think, that Putin does not want this May 25th election to take place? So Obama, of course, in commenting on the so-called truce that was announced in Geneva by the foreign ministers, he was pretty skeptical about it. So what's your reading on where things stand and where they're likely to head?
Well, everybody's skeptical, as they rightly should be. We're still waiting, and the European Union and the U.S. are still waiting for Russia to implement the agreement signed with the European Union over Georgia 6 years ago. But then the West didn't accuse Russia of being deceitful and lying. Today it is. When I've met Western diplomats in Kiev just a few days ago, they said openly to me they don't believe a word that's coming out of Moscow anymore. I receive a daily briefing from the U.S. State Department which counteracts against a whole host of Russian lies. And this is unprecedented that international diplomats are openly and publicly saying that another country, this case Russia, is just not saying anything truthful. Now, on the question of eastern Ukraine, I think it's an exaggeration to say everything is lost. Yes, it's a very weak government in Kiev because of financial, economic reasons. At the same time, the opinion polls show two things very important, that support for the separation of regions in eastern and southern Ukraine, which is primarily Russian-speaking, and support for some kind of federalism is extremely low throughout the region. What you've actually got is a higher level of support for that in Donetsk and Luhansk. Together they call the Donbass. And that's why Russia did begin this process of infiltration of eastern Ukraine in those two regions, because those two regions I mentioned before are very similar to the Crimea in terms of their national identity. But that's not been the case. There hasn't been evidence really of support elsewhere in eastern and southern Ukraine. Now, what we have is, in effect, a silent majority throughout that region. They don't like what's going on with these armed separatists and Russian intervention, but they also don't particularly like what's happened in Kiev either. So they've kind of become ambivalent and neutral. And in the meantime, a minority, with the help of green men from Russia or the Crimea, are taking charge and are causing havoc and taking charge of local situation, with the help, by the way, as in the Crimea, with the leader of the Crimea, Mr. Aksyonov, whose criminal name is Goblin, with the help of local organized crime. So you have this a minority imposing its will on the majority, which doesn't like them and doesn't like what's going on in Kiev. And that minority is composed of Russian green men, local organized crime, and some local pro-Russian nationalists. The Kiev response has been feeble. I've never been in the military myself, but I think I would have not sent in armored personnel carriers into a crowded place full of civilians, especially because these green men and these so-called tough Russian nationalists were hiding behind unarmed civilians. So that they were mistaken, but at the same time, there seems to be, according to the Ukrainian media, a very good record of capturing. They are detaining quite a lot of people. They are capturing a lot of weapons still coming in. The Geneva Agreement didn't stop any of this. The flow of weapons and explosives into Ukraine has continued. And, of course, the local separatists have just begun echoing Russian demands, which are for regime change in Kiev and for no elections to take place. So it does. I think the people in Kiev do come across as feeble in one stage. But on the other hand, they don't want to give Russia the excuse for intervention with massive bloodshed of civilians. And they also want to kind of keep the peace as much as possible, so that the elections can go ahead in approximately 5 weeks' time. So it's a very difficult balancing act.
But just looking at the broader picture, Taras Kuzio, we were talking earlier about the possible analogies to the build-up of World War I, given the 100th anniversary is coming up in August of this year. And Graham Allison at Harvard has written a piece suggesting that civil war in Ukraine could break out and could affect the Baltic regions, Poland, the Czech Republic, all of whom are quite concerned about Putin and his statements about his right to intervene in Ukraine and his reference to Novorossiya. So give us a sense then of how these and alliances and entanglements might unravel and what could be done to avoid that World War I scenario?
Well, the only thing, and I'm not trying to be a sort of a hardliner here, but the only thing the Russians understand is toughness. And that's why they laugh at the European Union, sadly. It's an institution with 28 members that finds it very difficult to reach a decision. They are afraid of the U.S., but less so of President Obama than, say, would have been of President Clinton or President Bush. So toughness is required. That means doing a whole host of things, such as, according to U.S. legislation, Putin is an exporter of terrorism. Declare him or threaten to declare him as an exporter of terrorism to other countries. In other words, he's a leader of a terrorist organization. Secondly,
specifically, what terrorism are you referring to?
Well, terrorism into eastern Ukraine and into the Crimea. And Russia has a record of doing this, of course, in Georgia, in Azerbaijan, and in Moldova. I mean, Ukraine is not the only place that Russia's undertaking a policy of supporting frozen conflicts or annexation of other countries' territories. And Russia's also undertaken terrorist acts in the Middle East against Chechen leaders who were there in exile. So there has been analysis by a professor from Rutgers University called Alexander Motyl, who wrote in the journal World Affairs Journal just recently, a few weeks ago, where he cited American legislation on how to define a country or entity or individuals involved in exporting terrorism. Putin fits the bill. Use that as a threat. Another threat that potentially could be used is against the $40 billion he's allegedly stashed in Switzerland and elsewhere in the West. Putin is the wealthiest individual in Russia. It's not Oleg Deripaska, the Russian oligarch. It's actually Putin. Threaten his assets, his personal assets. Make him persona non grata, expand the list. There are a lot more tougher things. Hold PFP. Ukraine has been a very active member for 2 decades now of NATO's Partnership for Peace program. Hold PFP exercises on the Russian-Ukrainian border, bringing foreign troops. I don't think so much Central Eastern Europe is threatened by what's happening in Ukraine, but certainly the three Baltic states, which were part of the USSR, an entity that, of course, Vladimir Putin thinks was regretfully disallowed to disintegrate, and the worst disaster in the 20th century, according to him. So certainly three Baltic states are going to feel very threatened now, especially because Latvia, for example, has more Russian speakers than Ukraine. Half of the population of Latvia are Russian speakers. You will hear more Russian in Riga than you will hear in Kiev. And in Latvia and Estonia, most of those, approximately two-thirds of the Russian speakers in both of those countries still don't have citizenship because of the very peculiar German, old-style German ethnic laws on acquiring citizenship. So the threat is potentially there. I don't think it's necessarily a threat to Poland or Romania. They're just too big members of NATO. But certainly to Moldova, Baltic states, northern Kazakhstan, one has to adopt a tough position, already set a real red line in the sand. Otherwise, we are going to have a repeat, of course, of the 1930s.
Well, just in closing, though, Taras Kuzio, it's one thing to get tough with Putin and another thing to get tough with the Russian people, who apparently do feel a collective sense of humiliation. And that and Putin may be using that cynically, but the fact remains that the Russian people feel that they have been humiliated and mistreated. So what do you do to address that rather than inflame the situation?
In any strong measures against undertaken, these have to be stressed to be that they are undertaken against the Russian leadership, not against Russia as a country, not against the Russian people. But beyond that, it's extremely difficult to put one's view across when the Russian media space, even more than it was even a few years ago, is so totally controlled by the Kremlin. And we do have propaganda, as European Union and American leaders have said, the propaganda spewing out of Moscow these days is worse than at the heights of the Cold War. So, yes, the Russian people feel aggrieved to some degree about what happened, but that's partly as a result of the very lopsided and lack of access to alternative sources of information that they've been given. What the Russian people should be looking at more, and this is something that could be broadcast through Western radio stations and other forms of sources of information, maybe through the internet and elsewhere, is the fact that the Russian leadership itself is the one that's betraying the country through terrible demographic crisis, terrible levels of corruption, far worse than anything in the 1990s, and that the Russia of today is actually a declining and dying great power. It's not something that can attract other countries. And during the Cold War, the USSR was a source of inspiration, whether we like it or not, for a whole host of people throughout the world. That's not the case today. So it's a rather bizarre situation where many Russians feel very proud of a country that's actually in terminal decline and where the population is going to decline terribly and where the average life expectancy is on the level of somewhere like Bangladesh. So I think we need to point these things out. We need to point out that anything we're doing tough is against the Russian leadership and not against the Russian people or the Russian state itself. That's going to be a tough measure when when the Russian media space is so tightly controlled, and even to the extent that the Russian equivalent of Facebook, which is called ВКонтакте, which has more viewers than Facebook in Russia, was actually just recently taken over by the Kremlin. That's the degree to which they are controlling the media space, in some ways even more than the last few decades of the USSR.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Taras Kuzio.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Taras Kuzio, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He's a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the turnaround in terms of the Detroit bankruptcy.